broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
On September 12, 1962, President John F. Kennedy gave his now famous "We Choose to Go to the Moon" speech at Rice University in Houston, Texas. On that sweltering day, he asked his audience a question. But why, some say, the moon? I've been asked a version of this question many times over the years. I've heard enthusiasts and apologists alike respond by citing the thrill of exploration, the Cold War, a quest for scientific understanding, the commercialization of Teflon and the invention of integrated circuits. Neither of the latter two is right, though one study found that every dollar spent by NASA on research and development ultimately returns $7 of value to the gross national product. But that day, President Kennedy answered his question with what, for me, is the most compelling argument. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. So it did. Jack Clemens, in his recent book, Safely to Earth, The Men and Women Who Brought the Astronauts Home. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writers Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. This summer, July 20, 2019, will mark the 50th anniversary of the day Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin became the first humans to land on the moon, while Command Module pilot Mike Collins orbited overhead. Jack Clemens' book reminds us of the special character, commitment, and intelligence of the men and women who worked to achieve Kennedy's 10-year goal of putting a man on the moon and bringing him and his two mates home safely. Jack is my guest today. He's a former lead engineer supporting NASA's Apollo program and also senior engineering software manager on the Space Shuttle program. Jack was part of the mission control backroom team that supported the NASA flight controllers on both the return of the Apollo 11 crew from the first moon landing and the rescue of the Apollo 13 crew. Jack, welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition.
Thank you for inviting me.
Jack, tell us a bit about your book and how you became involved in the Apollo program.
Okay, let's start with how I became involved in the Apollo program, and then the book came out of that experience.
Sure.
I was in college at the time at the University of Florida, of all places, when John F. Kennedy made his speech that you quoted, and I decided that's really what I wanted to be a part of. I had been interested in being a writer. I had done some not very successful writing in my early days. Really didn't know what I wanted to do.
What were you writing in your early days, Jack?
Kind of Hardy Boys ripoff books starring me and my close friend. They weren't very good, but it was. I had read the Hardy Boys books. My father was a private detective, so like the Hardy Boys, I had a father who was a detective, so I wrote some books about it. They were very derivative.
Super.
I still have several of them, which tells you how desperate I am to keep things. But I didn't know. I had done well in high school on both science and technology and physics classes, but it really didn't inspire me very much in terms of using it for anything. So I went to college. I was a sophomore at the University of Florida when that speech came out. I had been also reading a lot of science fiction as a younger man. So it was this sudden transformation for, I don't have to read science fiction or write science fiction. I could live science fiction because we're going to go to the moon. Those words didn't even make sense. To say those words didn't even make sense when I was in high school. It was science fiction idea. So the University of Florida had just started its aerospace engineering degree. I made that my major, graduated with a degree in so-called high-speed aerodynamics, which means things coming through the atmosphere very, very fast. And with the intent of coming out of that world and going to work on the space program.
That was a rather... two things, Jack, about that comment. That was a rather audacious statement at the time, wasn't it? Where were we in terms of the space program when Kennedy made his announcement?
We were desperately pretty far behind as a nation. I'm thinking it's like 52 or 53 when the Russians put up the Sputnik satellite, which was, of course, very, very primitive by almost any standard, but at the time was unique and really earth-shaking. We then, at that point, the Cold War was going on, and we as a nation decided that somehow the Russians had now beat us to a higher ground from which many, many bad things could be visited upon us, certainly tracking us, certainly watching... the ability to see what our missile program was like from space, the ability of the Russians to put missiles into space. It just became a terrifying concept that they were now moving into an area where we had no presence. We had had some early attempts to launch missiles, and they were very not very successful. There are still films of showing these rockets that we were launching from Cape Kennedy or Cape Canaveral at that time, blowing up on the pad. So it was frightening. And so under Dwight D. Eisenhower, we started the Mercury program. The Mercury program was our attempts to put humans into space. And those weren't going very well. And then the Russians beat us to space with human beings, Yuri Gagarin being the first. So we were in this world where we were getting taken a licking about something that we, number one, thought was the next technological frontier, but also was a place from which our enemies now had the high ground and presumably could do their evil best against us. So yes, it was daunting to be in that world, but for Kennedy to change that into, we're not only going to be there, we're going to be the first on the moon. We're going to put our humans into space and put them on the moon and bring them back. And his speech was in 1962. And he said, by the time this decade is out. So we had, 9 years?
Yeah.
That was it. And we were basically nowhere. We had, I think the Mercury program had some launches. The Gemini program was just underway. But we were a long, long, long way from having the ability to put something into an orbit that would take us away from Earth and all the way to the moon.
So it was really an audacious.
Yes, it was.
An audacious statement on the part of the president and also an audacious goal to go from almost nothing.
Right.
To landing someone on an object in space.
Right.
Jack, you mentioned that got you interested in the technological world, and which you were already fairly good at. But the Kennedy's speech in 62. kind of did something to the nation in terms of citing this audacious goal. other than getting you into the scientific area, how did it affect you personally? How did you respond to Kennedy's comments?
It was magical. We were in an emotional state as a nation that said we were getting beat on every side. Things were not going very well for us internationally. And there was this group of young folks that were looking for somebody to tell us otherwise, sort of the Elon Musk of our day, someone who would say, no, we have a vision. No, we can do this. Let's not just put a goal of putting that person on the moon. Let's bring them back and let's do it by the end of the decade. It was a formula that was energizing. And Kennedy had, for a lot of young people, myself included at that time, was this, it was almost like, analogy has always been Camelot. He was this magical leader that could inspire us to do things that we believed we could because he wanted us to. So that was part of it. And then, of course, when John F. Kennedy got assassinated, then this, number one, this implosion occurred on our emotional state, mine included. That was, even 10 years later, it was hard for me to watch video or movies of Kennedy without choking up because he had been an inspiration. But it also then became like, we're going to do this for him. So then it flipped itself over to, this is what Kennedy thought we should do. He died. We're going to do it for him. And it just produced this focus and this energy and this determination to get this done. Not really realizing at the time just how difficult, as I've mentioned to you in other forums, one of the shuttle astronauts has a comment, space is hard. Space is really hard. And we didn't know up front just how hard it was going to be.
Well, we're going to get into a little bit of that in a minute, because you were part of delving into that hard work and some of the solutions to the problems that going into space engendered at that time. Just to set this context a little bit, 1962 and the years following were the beginning of some very turbulent years in our own society and culture as well. So at the same time, we have this great vision of going into space on the streets. The civil rights movement was creating all kinds of activity and turmoil. And then a little bit later on, the anti-war movement. So we had, in addition to this vision of going into space, we're now facing very, very significant cultural changes as well. Can you comment on that a bit? And how did that affect as you began working on the Apollo program? How did that begin to affect your work and your attitude?
The short answer is quite a bit. So when I started at the University of Florida as a freshman, the big thing was, the so-called panty raids. So the freshman men would go over to the women's dorms, stand outside and wave and hope that the women would wave or show their panties or something silly. It was that kind of stuff.
Jack, I remember that very well, and I'm sure a number of our listeners remember that also.
Before I left, so now I'm in my, senior year up there, we're having anti-war riots. We're having now what's going on that campus is the Gainesville police are being brought in spraying demonstrators with paint so they could identify them later because they were protesting against the Vietnam War and especially protesting against the draft, which now every single one of those young men, me included, on that campus was subject to. And so this transformation in cultural behavior, even at the college level, was profound even 3 or 4 years apart from really silliness to this fear.
To burning draft cards.
You bet. You bet. And so that was a major effect. And it started to affect, what are you going to do if I'm over in Vietnam, for example, let's use me as the example, how am I going to work on the space program? Or there were a lot of young men who were leaving to go to Canada, who were leaving the United States. So it also had this effect of ebbing some of those same resources, those same energy that might have been applied directly to the program were leaving, either going to Canada or far worse, getting conscripted and going to Vietnam. That included some colleagues of mine that were my high school friends that then became roommates in college. So this turbulence was happening. Kennedy had gotten assassinated in 63. And so now this image, this person that could maybe save us from all of this was gone. The draft, the draft was going on. The kids were protesting. The whole Summer of Love came up in the late 60s. The Vietnam War got worse and worse. And so there's this chaos surrounding us that said, how could we possibly focus on doing something like going to the moon? But honestly, at the time, it was because Kennedy challenged us to do it that we still wanted to do it. The nation kind of focused around this thing that was a good thing, a positive thing. And especially when some of the Russian spacecraft weren't doing so well and our Gemini program was starting to do very well, it looked like we were starting to get an edge on the Russians, at least in the area of space travel, human space travel. So that became, it was this turmoil, but it was like this brief shining moment, to use the Camelot phrase, this brief shining moment in the middle of all this that said, we've got to make this thing happen.
It really shows to some degree that the capacity of a great nation to be able to deal with the internal turmoil of the civil rights movement and the war that were changing our culture. Our culture was changing radically in the 60s, to looking outside, beyond ourselves, to this totally esoteric goal of going out there instead. So I see almost a schizophrenic sense in the country, which really for me testifies to its strength, not to a weakness. So you decided on space instead of slogging through the jungles of Vietnam. Tell us how you came to work on the Apollo program and what you did.
Okay. Well, so shortcut was, it turned out I wasn't qualified physically for the draft, so I ended up not getting drafted, so then I could go ahead and work on the space program. In addition, as it happens in those days, if you worked on a military program or a space program for the government, because those skills were in such great demand, you would get a draft deferment anyway, because you were needed for those. So I ended up working kind of a little ragged path, but I ended up working for a company by the name of TRW Systems in Houston, Texas. TRW today and then makes auto parts and tire supplies and things like that. But in those days, all companies were expanding to get be part of the space business. So they had a group called TRW Systems Group, and one of their locations was in Houston, Texas, out at the area around the Space Center, an area that is then and now called Clear Lake City. Directly across the street from the missions, from the what became the Johnson Space Center, where all the missions were being planned, where all the astronauts were training, and where during the flights themselves, the missions were being controlled out of there. So NASA had a limited number of people. This was all new stuff. And it's not like we had these, you know, gray hairs that could come in from the earlier manned space program and start working. When I got down there, I was probably 25 or 26, I guess, early 20s. And that was round number. That was the average age of those folks in mission control during those days. This was a young group of people. And they didn't have enough NASA folks on their own to go manage all that stuff. So they hired a lot of contractors. TRW was one of those. And so I was an engineer working for TRW that was sort of the extra arms and legs of the NASA folks directly, literally directly across the street. So we were doing, what we did was in our particular contract had to do with helping them do all the planning from a mission control point of view and from a space center point of view, all the planning of a mission from through training, through launch, to the moon, come back, reentry, landing, and analysis. We were their extra arms and legs. And in my particular background being high-speed aerodynamics meant I would get assigned to the reentry portion of the flight. In fact, I was hired because of that degree, because that's the part where you're coming back from the moon and you'd very, very much like to land in the ocean without any falderol. And that's a very difficult thing to do.
To set the, we'll get into that in a moment, because I find it quite intriguing. But you came in, there were 17 Apollo missions, right. I think I read in your book. Mm-hmm. And where did you come in that spectrum?
Okay, so I came in I sat down at my desk at TRW when the Apollo 7 mission was orbiting overhead. That was the first manned flight of an Apollo spacecraft in orbit around the Earth. There had been an earlier attempt, so-called Apollo 1.
There was a tragedy with Apollo 1.
That was the one where there was a fire inside the cockpit. As they were training for the launch, all three astronauts were killed. Set the program back quite a way because they had to completely redesign the way the command module itself was built. They had to allow for exit from that spacecraft from the inside, which they hadn't done. They had to it was a major change. So that was Apollo 1. And it, by the way, set back the program for almost 2 years, considering that we're doing a countdown to 1969. That was a two-year chunk taken out of it. So once we got the first time we were able to get back into space was they numbered the flight Apollo 7. There had actually been a couple of unmanned launches of Apollo in between just to get it up there and down. So this was the first ever Apollo mission. And that was October, I think, of 1968. And that's when I sat down at my desk and asked where the washroom was and how do I get lunch and all that sort of stuff and trying to meet my classmates. So October 68. And then I worked on all the missions through Apollo 17. From that point forward.
So you worked on reentry. Because of your background, right. and your expertise. Mm-hmm. In terms of reentry, which was a new experience for us, right. in the space program.
With humans,
with humans. So, what were the issues? What were some of the? Get a little bit into the weeds here.
Okay.
What were some of the issues that you had to deal with?
Okay. And by the way, if your audience is interested in this, I'd be happy if they went out and bought this book somewhere because it's all in there. In fact, the more of those books they buy, the happier I'll be. So the nation's experience in reentry vehicles had to do with guided missiles. So it when you're launching something and you're trying to take out the Ruskies and those things are shaped like bullets. They pointy front end, they come down through the atmosphere, and when things are traveling fast, and these travel 25,000 miles per hour or so when they're coming back from the moon. And they come into the atmosphere. That atmosphere is just like is thick. It's almost like water, and it can heat. It can at that speed, it heats the spacecraft up to such a great degree that it could actually melt the spacecraft.
Is it a gradual thickening or is it boom?
It's gradual. Well, gradual in a sense. When you're coming at 25,000,
it's pretty quick.
Yeah, but yeah, it builds up pretty quickly. And so on missiles, on a guided missile, then these are built of all these steel and other properties that can take that heat. But that was way too much weight if you're going to put an astronaut into orbit and have him come back. We didn't have any launch capacity to build something that heavy and put astronauts in it and launch it to the moon.
What were we using to what was the launch methodology? What was the rocket? Let me get it straight.
All right. So the rocket they used was Saturn V, and it's the biggest thing still that the United States has ever built to put anything into space. The dilemma of getting things into space is that things are heavy. That's the space is hard thing, and so originally when we're launching rockets like guided missiles. Those don't weigh very much. You could build something that looks like a rocket ship, launch it into space, and then this thing comes in. Once things get bigger and bigger and heavier, then every pound of weight requires more thrust, more engine, more fuel. And so initially, we didn't even think it was, we being the United States, didn't even think it was possible to put a, how do you get a human up there? Because you don't have enough, there's not a rocket powerful enough to do that. They ultimately came into something called stages. And so the Saturn V has three stages, lower, middle, and upper. And each of those have rockets in them, and each of them have fuel. And as you're lifting off with that first stage, when you finally use all the fuel, you also drop that stage completely out. So now not only is the fuel gone, but you've thrown a bunch of weight away. Now you have two more sections.
And it burns up and it burns when up. It comes back.
It splashes into the ocean if you're lucky and not into somebody's neighborhood. And then the second stage gets you up there. And that goes, now you're going further out over the ocean. Same thing there. You still need a lot of fuel to get that thing into orbit. But the container for that fuel weighs so much. When you use up its fuel, you dump it too. And then the third stage finally is the one that takes you up all the way into orbit and gets you into orbit around the Earth. And then later that stage is also used to start to propel you on the way to the moon before you dump it. So that's the staging. And the difficulty in all space flights, including today, if you watch Elon Musk's dropping his landing, right down on the surface of the Earth, the difficulty is weight. Things weigh a lot. Humans weigh a lot. When humans go into space, then they have to take all the things that allow them to breathe and eat and drink with them. And you know, that all that weight is the hard part of getting into space. And so when that astronaut made the comment, space is hard, that's part of what's hard, is just even getting up there and then keeping the environment such that you can live up there when you don't have access to, you know, McDonald's or a hospital or even air. So that was hard part of it. And the Saturn V rocket, that was the one that was built explicitly to get humans into space and to the moon.
And then you've got to come back got human beings here
to pick up
your narrative again about the issues that you deal with on bringing this final stage back into space,
back into
Earth.
Right. So the astronauts have gotten up there. They've orbited the moon, then they landed on the moon. They've dug up the moon rocks and done their science. They're coming back. So coming back from the moon is the opposite of hard. Coming back from the moon is easy. It's precisely because the moon is much smaller and has a much lower gravitational field than Earth. So the Earth is like this big magnet and trying to – a gravity magnet. So when you get it off there, it's really, really hard to get off the surface. When you're coming back from the moon, you're on a downhill slide, coming back really, really fast. And if you do nothing at all, you'll come all the way back to Earth without any help. It's exactly like throwing a ball into the air. It takes a lot to get it to go high. To catch it, you just put your glove out. That same exact thing happens. In fact, it's the same effect. It's gravity, except gravity this time you've gone all the way out to the moon. The moon has enough gravity to keep you there if you want to stay, but not enough to stop you if you're coming back. So now you're coming, quote, downhill. And if you've read anything about the destruction of the dinosaurs, you know that something really big, really fast, if it hits Earth, can do a lot of damage. That's because these things are massive. And when anything is traveling at 25 or 30,000 miles per hour, it can do horrendous damage. So the question is, how do you get these guys back? And they were all guys. We didn't get women astronauts until the space shuttle. So they were just all white American test pilots, astronauts. You have to figure out a way to get them back in such a way that doesn't kill them, doesn't cause them to miss the Earth. The Earth, even though it's large from the distance of the moon, if you could bypass it entirely on the way back and whip around, that would be a bad day because they don't have enough fuel on board to keep circling the Earth. Once they come back, they've got to come in. So part of it is that, and the only friend you have on this thing is the atmosphere. When you start coming back to Earth, you have the ability to do little corrections. You can fire the engines a little bit and shift here and there, but you have nothing strong enough to actually slow the astronauts down and then fly. It would take another spacecraft bigger than that, shuttle. So
when you talk about Was it the lunar module or what?
That came back?
Yeah.
The command module.
The command module. Oh, yeah. The command module has, though, you said, a certain corridor.
Right.
That it has to enter in. And say a little bit about that corridor. It isn't a straight drop. You've got to calculate. I mean, this is what, to me, would get hard, because you've got to calculate that corridor.
Correct.
And the appropriate corridor and stay within that corridor. Tell us a bit about how you did that.
Okay. So the command module reentry behaves opposite of what a ballistic missile is. If the command module looks like a big Hershey's Kiss. Big flat back end, pointed at the top.
Why does it come in with the big flat end?
For two reasons. One, that's where the heat shield is. So you have to keep it from burning up somehow. If you had it pointed straight forward, there's just not enough material there to dissipate all that heat. So it's designed to be like a Hershey's Kiss with a flat end first, and then all over that surface is a material that could absorb the heat of reentry. And then have it float away rather than burn straight through the command module. It's called an ablative heat shield. Ablation simply means that hard material heats up and converts directly to a gas and get blown away. So this thickness on the fat end of this thing is called the heat shield. And it's just, as you come back into the atmosphere and this thing is trying to slow you down because it's big and fat, it'll try to slow you down. But it also has to get rid of all that heat in the process. And then to slow you down enough so that you can then open your parachutes and come down. Well, if you're coming back from the moon, the Earth, of course, is round, and that's what we look at it. We always draw these pictures of like the atmosphere being flat, like when an airplane goes through it. But it isn't. It's round, just like the Earth. So as you're coming back from the moon, if you come in a little too shallow, not quite enough, you'll hit the tip of the atmosphere, but you keep on going. There's just not enough air there to slow you down. So you want to go a little closer to the Earth. You want to come in deeper than that and hit the atmosphere more square, more like a belly flop. But if you do that too much, then you come, it is like a belly flop. You come straight down into the atmosphere, and then that would produce so much stress on the spacecraft, it could break it up. And, of course, the astronauts with it. So you had to do this little, as I've mentioned in the book, this Goldilocks thing, not too shallow, not too deep, just exactly right. And that was the so-called reentry corridor. When you came back from the moon, you had to get in within a certain degree of depth into the atmosphere, but not too much. And that window was about 7 or 8 degrees. That's it. So you'd come in deep enough to have this thing start pounding on you, enough that it would build up enough for an astronaut inside the spacecraft. It was 6 or 7 G's, which means you're basically flattened to your seat. You can't do much. Slowing this thing down, but not so deep that it would cause them to pass out, which would happen about 8 or 9 G's, or at 20 G's, destroy it. So that's what you would do. So that would be pretty simple by itself, but that's what it was. We'd come back, had to hit the quarter, and you do that by deciding when to leave the moon and then sort of firing those engines up there, hoping that it'll work itself out. So by that time that path intersects Earth, it'll hit it at that right angle, correct angle. If you happen to be off a little bit, you have the ability to correct that angle that you're coming back in slightly up or down. So you come in a little deeper, a little shallower, but not much. So then that's all fine if you had recovery ships all over the Pacific Ocean, but you don't. You only have a few recovery ships. Not only that, but nasty things like hurricanes come up, and where you were going to land isn't the place you can land in the ocean anymore because there's a storm out there. So in addition to everything else, you had to actually fly this Hershey's Kiss with flat end backward. You had to fly it from where you hit the atmosphere to the to the recovery ship, wherever that was in the Pacific. And that was the next part of the job.
So we're going to go on to the space shuttle, and I'm sure flying this Hershey's Kiss contributed to how then the space shuttle was flown on its reentry as well. So tell us who was flying this thing, and in this context, what does flying mean?
Okay. Well, who was flying it? Who was flying it was, there was a very, at the time, very advanced, and in retrospect, very primitive onboard computer that could do that flying. And the way it flew is, as I mentioned in my book, if you're sitting in an automobile, hopefully on the passenger side, and you stick your hand out the window, you're going 40 miles an hour, so stick your hand out the window flat. So imagine that's the command module, the front, the base of the command module going through the air. It's pushing back on you. But I want to go up a little bit. I need to, if I keep going like this, I'm going to come short of where the, so I need to somehow go up. I can tilt my hand a little bit, stick your hand out the window, and that air pushing will push your hand up. If I want to go to the right, I can rotate my hand kind of out to the right. It'll kick it to the side. Now, of course, if cars are coming, that's a bad deal. If I wanted to go closer to the ground, I'd put my... So just imagine your hand slightly tilted out that window, but rotating left, right, and up and down, and you can start moving that command module or your hand back and forth, up and down. And that's how that command module flew. And the onboard computer could do that, but it was fairly primitive. And so the astronauts had a secondary set of displays and controls that they could look at to check to see if that computer was working. And if not, or if they were concerned, they could take over manually and fly it, doing much the same thing. Now, they were using their hands sort of to land this thing. And what you would do is slow it down. Okay, I'm not going to burn up anymore, but now I got to get over the ship, and it's another, whatever, 500 miles downrange than I thought. It's over to the left. Start spinning your hand or the computer, the spacecraft. And there were little engines on the outside of the command module around the side of it, not pointing forward or back, but around the side. And when you commanded it left or right, it would rotate that command module, and they would flow. That's how they'd fly it. And they could fly it until it had slowed all the way down. And if you did it right, you'd finally pop those parachutes, and when you landed, the recovery ship would be right underneath you. And that meant, and that's what it meant to fly one of those. And yes, when we got to Space Shuttle, that same technology, a very similar technology was used, because the Space Shuttle, when it was re-entering, you entered belly up, just like the command module.
Well, talk a little bit about the Space Shuttle, okay. Jack. You were involved with that as well.
Mm-hmm. So the Space Shuttle was the next generation, and it was, and although people find it hard to believe, the Apollo missions ran into the 70s. Space Shuttle started flying in 81 or 82, and everything in that time had changed. Now all the technology that was lacking on Apollo now existed on Space Shuttle. So
the computers were a little bit more sophisticated
much more sophisticated.
Yeah.
On Space Shuttle, because of the way it looks, it's designed like an aircraft to launch and land, vertically and land. It in order to keep that thing stable, a human couldn't fly it. You couldn't manipulate it fast enough to keep it from spinning on its side. So Space Shuttle had an onboard computer system that flew everything. There were even areas like reentry and launch where if an astronaut took control, the computer may not let them take control because a motion there might have been unstable. So it would even override, in certain cases, the astronaut's control to make sure they stayed safe. So very different world from primitive technology where, you know, with slide rules.
Why is it shaped so much differently? How did the shuttle, we're going to deal with this heat issue
right.
Again. How did the space shuttle dissipate the heat of reentry?
Well, two things. The way it dissipated it was a very different way than on Apollo. On Apollo, it was a blade of material that moved away. For shuttle, the technology had moved to the point now where you could put materials around the shuttle wings that some of them might be damaged, some not, but most of them could be reused. The key with the space shuttle was it was supposed to be reusable. On an Apollo spacecraft, nothing was reused, nothing. If once you did a mission, the only thing that ever came back was that command module, and it was charred to beyond recognition on the outside, so nothing was ever reused. Shuttle, the intent was to reuse everything. They didn't quite get there, but close. So that meant that the spacecraft, the materials used, and again, a transformation in technology, the materials used there were ones that could absorb that heat.
These were the famous tiles,
yes.
Right?
And also, it wasn't designed to go to the moon. It was designed to use Earth orbit, which changes the when you're coming, you're not coming back from space from quite so far away. So instead of 25 or 30,000 miles per hour reentry, you might be at, I don't know, 18.
Because you're coming back from the space station,
right,
which is orbiting the Earth.
Yeah, and closer. And so you don't have that kind of speed build up. So it doesn't take quite the same kind of materials that you use for Apollo.
Is there any kind of override on the space shuttle in terms of driving it or flying it or no?
In certain areas, no. The first part of reentry, no. When you're coming back from space at those kind of speeds, even in some, and imagine it looks like an aircraft, right? So you can imagine the kind of things it's getting beat up with the air coming all around you. And that onboard computer is constantly hunting, constantly moving, keeping it stable. Because it could tilt left, tilt right, go up. So it's at places like that, the astronauts really couldn't really take over and do much. They might be able to command left or right, but the onboard computers would take a look at that command and go, well, I'll give you a little of this, but not much.
Yeah.
Right.
One of the things in your book that struck me about the shuttle is that it isn't really an airplane at all. It's just a huge glider.
That's right.
And whereas Apollo, you're kind of dropping in this corridor into space, this thing is going to fly.
Right.
And what were the issues you dealt with relative to the corridor or was there a corridor for the space shuttle?
There was always a corridor, but because the space shuttle had the wings and the onboard computer, it wasn't coming in at the same kinds of speeds.
What was the speed, Jack? We had 25,000 miles an hour for Apollo. What is this thing?
I'm going to answer and then be wrong.
That's okay.
But it's about 15, 20,000.
We can go to your book and find the real number.
We don't want to shuffle around here.
That's right.
Yeah, slower. How's that? Substantially slower. And it is in the book. It escapes me. So let me back up one more time. It also had a special feature in those wings. These wings on the space shuttle, as you know, if you've seen any mission, launch mission or landing, those are big. And we don't really need that. Something the size of the Apollo command module could skim around, didn't have any wings at all. Those wings were there because NASA and the Air Force both wanted to use shuttle. And the Air Force had their missions going not out of the Cape Canaveral launch facility, but out of Vandenberg Air Force Base on the West Coast. And those missions went south, not east. When you're flying something east and it's a spacecraft, the Earth helps you spinning, gets you started. When you're flying south out of Vandenberg, the Earth's moving away from you. And so you've gone up, you go into orbit. When you come back, even if you do a perfect orbit, when you come back to where you were, Vandenberg's moved off to your left somewhere if you're coming from the north. So the shuttle had to have larger wings on it because it was a glider. And now it had to glide not just downrange, but all the way over to wherever the Pacific Coast had moved since they left. And that's explained in the book why that was done. But it was basically the secrecy of missions. And the Air Force wanted to put something in orbit very quickly, get it up there into orbit, drop off a satellite of some sort, come right back, and not have anybody detect them. And to do that, you'd go south over the Pacific because there's nothing out there. So that glider, it was a glider for the same reason that the Apollo was a glider, that it's just these things, there aren't engines powerful enough that are also very lightweight, that can allow you to fly a spacecraft at those kind of speeds. So you put wings on it, you're going fast, so you probably don't need much of a propulsion system. It's a glider. It's not a glider during ascent because you got the rocket behind you. It's not a glider so much in space. You can fire these engines and go up and rendezvous with the space station, do other things. And you use the rocket to start the reentry into the atmosphere. But after that, you're just gliding. And so the place they wanted to land was at the Kennedy Space Center on a runway.
Jack, how today important is the shuttle program to us. What did the shuttle program give us?
Okay, actually, a couple of things. Apollo was sort of a proof of concept, but it was never intended to be the end game itself. It was, couldn't we put humans on the moon and bring them back safely, and what would we learn from that? But we never had a plan there.
I like your phrase, by the way, a proof of concept. that sounds like a very scientific and engineering phrase
it was.
To me.
It's one of those things where the engineers do it to show that it could be done, but we're not really ready to take passengers, let's put it that way. And you can see how long it's taken for us to figure out how to do it for human beings that aren't test pilots. The space shuttle was intended to be practical from the beginning. It was to be put up into orbit, to get humans operating in orbit. It was to be used to build the space station, which it did. It took most of the components up to space. The astronauts in space fashioned, you know, through spacewalks, fashioned the International Space Station. It was used to put the Hubble Space Telescope into orbit. It was used to go back to the Hubble Space Telescope and repair it.
So we wouldn't have the Hubble.
Or the space station.
Without it. Or the space station.
You have to get those things up there somehow, and they were launched in parts. So it was intended to be a working program. That's why it was called the shuttle, like a truck. Shuttle stuff up and back, put it together, make it work, and get humans into space on a permanent or semi-permanent basis doing real work, real things. And it did.
You mention in your book, you have a wonderful chapter toward the end on the most asked questions that you get. Pick two of those as an example, and tell us about these questions.
Okay, well, so I'll pick two. There are some interesting ones I'd like to try, but I won't. How about Apollo 13? One of the questions I get asked.
Excellent. I was going to ask you about Apollo 13.
Yeah. It was considered a success, and yet, in fact, the astronauts that went there nearly died on the way out or back. They certainly never got to the moon. It was caused by a design failure in one of the components. So, and it was the first flight after Apollo 12. So Apollo 11 landed on the moon in 69. Apollo 12 was designed to go to the moon at the end of 69, just in case 11 didn't make it. We could still make Kennedy's date. Apollo 13 is the next one, April. And so it was a complete failure in terms of landing on the moon. But all of the Apollo missions, except that one, had been rehearsed and thought through so many different ways. There were so many contingency plans, and what would we do if this happens and this happens? All that study, all those years of practice were put to work on Apollo. And I'm not saying Apollo was easy. It was very, very difficult. But it's something that we prepared for many different ways, and with the support on the ground, the crew, what were we going to do if they couldn't land? How would we pick them up? All of this stuff was worked out. Apollo 13 was out of the blue when the component of the spacecraft that was moving Apollo to the moon exploded. You then had astronauts on their way to the moon and no way to get back. And what made that a success was everybody had to pitch in and go figure out then, in a period of days, how we're going to bring them back. How do we compensate for all those losses? How do we get the lunar module to play the role of getting them back there when it's not even designed for more than two people to land on the moon? How do you get them back, and how do you do it safely, and how do you preserve their power? It was an incredible success because it showed how that same group could work on the fly on a brand new problem where lives were at stake and pull it off and make it happen. It's a success equal to Neil Armstrong's first step on the moon.
What happened with Apollo 13? What caused the explosion? There were studies done, I know, and a film made, Ron Howard's
good
film.
Good one, by the way.
Yeah. What happened to those guys?
So once they head off to the moon, the Apollo spacecraft has three parts to it. It has the command module, which we've been talking about a lot. It has the lunar module, which attaches to its front. It also had a thing called the service module. And it wasn't designed to have any people in it. What it was the fuel, the water, the oxygen, the power, everything was in the back of that thing. And so it was like the storage compartment in your house. Something exploded inside there and blew it out. It blew out the side of that service module. That is also the engine that were being used to get to the moon and come back. So everything associated with power, water, survivability, engine use, all of it was destroyed when that thing blew up. It turned out to be a fairly small problem, as these always are. An electrical wire was exposed to heat, and it blew up the back of that. It turned out that was a problem that could have happened on other Apollo missions, like the one that went to the moon on Apollo 8. On Apollo 8, though, we didn't have a lunar module with us, so that would have been a really, really bad day if it happened on 8. But it happened on 13, and they figured out how to use the Apollo lunar module as sort of the lifeboat to bring them back.
Jack, I'll have to send people to your book for the other question.
Please do.
Questions. They are really fascinating. But I want to ask you, your colleagues working on the space program during this era. Who were these people? What kind of culture? What kind of people? We get a lot about the astronauts, and they are incredible people in their own right. But the people who we see high-fiving in the big room when things are successful, who are these engineers? Who are these people?
They're people like me. I mean, there were 400,000 of us. One of the questions I get a lot in the book is, did we fake the moon program? No. But there are 400,000 of us. And those people are largely not known except to their colleagues in that particular area. In my case, I knew the people working on reentry and such. I didn't know the people that were out, you know, helping the pull the command module out of the water. There were 400,000 of us all over the world, and they were just us. They were the astronauts. Neil Armstrong had this comment about being the first man on the moon. His comment was, I'm just the top point of this pyramid. I don't deserve that role, celebration any more than anybody else. There are 400,000 people that made this happen. I just happen to be the one that gets to step out first. He's right. And so part of what I've done in the book is say, look, I can't give you the background of 400,000 people, but I have the background of a couple hundred that I work with. And I'll try to show you those folks, the astronauts, the support people that I work with, because they were dedicated. They genuinely believed that they could do this. NASA had a failure is not an option attitude. It was really clear during those days. They didn't want infighting. We all worked on one team. We all worked as if we were NASA folks, personally and individually responsible for the security and safety of those astronauts. And we were making sure that whatever the heck anybody else was doing, we had to do ours right. Because if ours wasn't right, it was not going to work.
Thing that I got in your book that amazed me is that you've got 400,000 people working on this problem that really boils down to one problem: getting these people into space and getting them back again. 400,000 people working on little pieces of this, like you, space shuttle. You worked on the computers, I understand from your book. How did these pieces all come together and function? What was the structure that allowed this to happen?
It was NASA. It was the NASA leadership. Their attitude of failure is not an option wasn't just words. So the same thoroughness that my NASA counterpart worked with me and making sure all this stuff is right and holding me accountable for all the small things, that was working across the board. And it's astonishing, really. I mean, it wasn't without its near misses, or in one case, actually the death of the Apollo 1 astronauts. But it worked because this group thing, this mission and this group accountability was burned into everybody's DNA at that time. We weren't going to have this thing fail because I forgot to some thing I was supposed to tell the astronauts on, you know, that was a culture, and it's very rare. It doesn't exist. I thought at the time, by the way, that that's the way government and contractors work together. As I was discussing with one of my colleagues not too long ago, it was sort of sad to find out that was the exception, not the rule.
I still find it amazing that that 400,000 people can put a puzzle together that works with such mathematical certainty, and
that's why people think we faked the moon program, by the way, because it is hard. But it was redundancy and backup and what ifs, and this wasn't going to be this part I talked to you about reentry. My whole role was preparing the astronauts to take over in case the system didn't work. I didn't have anything to do with actually designing the programs that were going to fly reentry. My whole role was check it and make sure it's okay, and if it isn't, what do you do about it? That was my job, and that's the mentality that went into all this.
Jack, where are we today? We've got just a couple of minutes left, but tell us where we are today with the space program and how you see it.
We're in a sad state of affairs at the moment. Space Shuttle was intended to be the bridge to a next layer of spacecraft that could then do even more work and get more humans. And we had objectives in those days of not only space station, but then maybe we could go to the moon or asteroids or Mars or whatever. But it was a continuum that was supposed to be built on the technology one after another. And Shuttle was canceled because at the time NASA was getting cut back on funding. And so they wanted to go start working on this other program that would take us to the moon. So Shuttle was canceled. That other program was canceled, and we ended up having to use Russians to get ourselves back and forth to the space station.
So now, Jack, we're sending these probes into space. We've mm-hmm. got things crawling on Mars and then thinking about how to get machines into deep space, right. and send information back. In reflecting on the goal of going to the moon, are we going to go to Mars? Are we going to put human beings on Mars? What do you think?
So if the answer to we is humanity, yes. Yes, we are. If you're asking, will the United States put people on Mars? I don't know. I just don't know. I'm not even sure it's a reasonable thing to do. But humanity focuses around the space program as a whole. Just like during those terrible days during the Apollo era, when everything was falling apart in the world, when Neil Armstrong stepped out on the moon, people in other countries were saying, we did it. Not NASA, not America, humans went. That is something that I believe humans will do and will continue to do.
Jack, I want to thank you very, very much for coming on Delmarva Today Writer's Edition. And I want to encourage our listeners to buy your book and to read it. It's a fascinating book. Well written, well designed, well done, with a ton of information in it. So I highly recommend it. I began the program with a paragraph from your book. Let me end the program with a paragraph from your book. And that paragraph is, beyond all the science and technology research and placement of numerous commercial, military, and civilian payloads and satellites in orbit, these two achievements alone, the International Space Station and Hubble, were realized only because the space shuttle was there to bring them into existence. These are marvels witnessed and only barely imagined in the long history of humanity. How does one place a value on the immeasurable? Thanks again, Jack, for an excellent discussion. And thank you all for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.